Forensics Podcast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by Disc Labs. Find out more about our services at disclabs.com. Hello, welcome to Forensic Forecast. We've got another special episode today. Joining us again, I don't know why he keeps coming back. It's like a boomerang. It's Rob Lee. How are you doing, Rob?
Hey, Lee. Thanks for having me back. With an introduction like that, why do I ever bother?
Now, Rob's joining us today to talk about something which... To those people in the know, it's not new, but it's just coming to the fore now. CDFS, the Consortium of Digital Forensic Specialists. And whereas, you know, a couple of other people have already released podcasts with information about this. I mean, Ovi, he talked to Cindy Murphy. Joe, he spoke to this guy I not really heard of before called Eric Huber. But... we're really, really privileged to get the man himself, the icon, the legend, Rob Lee, to talk about it. There you go. How's that for an introduction instead?
And then we have some other dude who's also going to be talking about it today. It's Lobry.
So, Rob, if you wouldn't mind, would you just like to give us a bit of information on... you know, what is CDFS? I mean, obviously the title will give some of it away, but yeah, just how did it come about to start with?
Great question, Lee. And I actually really think, you know, all kidding aside, thanks for having me on your show again. I really appreciate it. And, you know, really appreciate everything that you do for the digital forensics community. This effort has, for the consortium has been going for actually many years now. And I to be able to put my own personal spin on it, you know, very similar to what Cindy and Eric accomplished, I think I'm going to first tell from the perspective of how I got involved and, you know, what where things came from. So stop me asking questions along the way here if you want me to go further into something. But back in 2008, I was with the, and still am with the SANS Institute. I was teaching a course and... big headlines occurred back in January 2008, where Texas had passed part of its public safety a measure that essentially forced the licensure of digital forensic specialists who are collecting or analyzing evidence in the state of Texas. In addition to that, there was a second provision that was added to that, which was talking about vulnerability assessments for digital investigators, that anyone who's doing pen testing or vulnerability assessments would also actually have to be required licensure as a private investigator. So actually both of those were going to be included in that. And asterisks for the vulnerability assessment stuff, less than a month later, somehow that was overturned, but they left the digital forensics piece as still part of the requirements that anyone in the state of Texas working as a third-party consultant would be required to have to become a PI. And so a lot of the origination consortium actually came from this origination from saying that the private investigators had a very well thought out professional organizations, usually per state and some national level organizations as well, that essentially spoke and promoted things on their behalf, you know, which they should for a professional organization. And they typically see digital forensics as something that says, well, if you're investigating a person, that kind of fits into what we usually do, you know, sitting outside Motel 6 and, you know, or, you know, looking for cheating husbands and wives and that kind of thing. I mean, you know, most private investigators, you know, while we joke around about it, we see them, you know, in a lot of different modes. You know, some people I know have hired them, you know, to check backgrounds on certain individuals and those type of things. But, you know, a lot of it ends up being, fascinatingly, a lot of the standard, let's, you know, dive through a dumpster type stuff. You know, actually diving through a dumpster, not, yeah, you know, what we, you know, electronic people think that is. So I had a conversation with the head of SANS, Alan Pollard, you know, mentioning to him about this. And Alan introduced me to a young lady named Jody Westby. And Jody is a lawyer in the DC area that worked with, works in, is on the Science and Technology Committee of the American Bar Association. And she and I started a conversation on this mainly to say, you know, does the legal field really understand that this is happening and what are their thoughts on it? And she said that they really didn't know what was going on in regards to this, but specifically that she was very interested and wanted to follow up on this after she brought it to the Science and Technology Committee that was going to be meeting later that summer. And she would reach out to me and, you know, we'd come up with a plan. But her proposal was to potentially put forward larger ABA a stand or essentially an opinion as to whether or not they thought that this was a good idea or not. About 2 to 3 weeks after that point, I was introduced to Toby Finney from the High Tech Crime Consortium, HTCC. And she invited me onto an already existing board that was put together loosely surrounding efforts trying to figure out from digital forensics perspective how to discuss the PI challenge, meaning, you know, is this what we want? Is this the direction that we want to head in? And that group was called, you know, tongue-in-cheek a little bit here, called Lemon Pie, with PI but without the E at the end. And, you know, to all extents, I know a lot of PIs who are digital forensicators, and, you know, we're really trying, no offense to them, but, you know, most of even those individuals agreed that most PI licensure has nothing to do about anything, how experienced you are with a PC. And we've seen how challenging this has become over the years. I mean, Lee, some of the work you've done and what you presented even at the summit, you know, shows this. You know, we have PhDs quoted as saying that it's impossible for anyone to tell if the system time's been updated, but, you know, through your research, you're able to say, no, it's actually not true. Here's what you need to do. And so when you have PhD-level individuals saying this, you know, this becomes quite complex. And with a little bit of work, anyone out there would be able to combat that. So time goes forward. That summer, I get a call from, and, you know, we're starting to work on the Lemon Pie and, you know, getting additional members to join. I was introduced to Chris Kelly at this point, who is one of the leading members of the consortium. And Chris was in that group, was currently fighting a provision, what was going on in the state of North Carolina. And I was kind of late to that party, but at that point, I was also working still with Jody Westby on that piece. And so essentially both efforts essentially joined at that point in the summer of 2008. And Jody, bless her heart, decides to call me. And I remember it was a Wednesday night, and I was actually deployed on a case down in Florida. And she calls me, literally, I'm sitting in my hotel room thinking, oh, you know, which pizza joint am I going to be going to that night? And this call from her, and she says, hey, remember that proposal where we need to write a statement? Well, that needs to be done tomorrow, or do you have some time to write? And I said, sure, but I think I need some help. So I called Toby Finney because Toby's really passionate about this stuff. And so Toby and I, with Jody's help, and Jody leading it, we drafted for the Science and Technology Committee to put forward for the ABA. Essentially, if you go out online, the ABA opinion, it's literally word for word what we put together. And a part of the verbiage of that, you know, and Jody led us to this point. She said, listen, I think the ABA is in agreement that the PI side of things is not the direction to head in. However, this does point to the fact that a professional organization of some sort needs to start to work together to represent digital forensic specialists, you know, in all fields. So we added a line at the bottom of that stating that the ABA does endorse the creation of a larger organization that could, piece of that could be a, you know, additional licensure for DF specialists only, or it could be just a set of standards or something needs to be created to be able to represent the larger group. That overall opinion, which basically says, we don't think PIs are the answer, we think a separate group should be formed, that passed unanimously across the ABA and was released in August of 2008. And during this entire time, you had the North Carolina group also, you know, consistently testifying down there, and essentially staved off an effort to license PIs in North Carolina. Since 2008, ever since the ABA has released their opinion, which they ended up sending to, in the United States, all 50 states, I don't think another state has actually passed a law stating that digital forensics professionals should be pulled under the PI for the public safety board, so, you know, per state. One thing that I think a lot of individuals, you know, sometimes they forget here in the U.S. that licensure is a state-regulated endeavor, that if you're going to practice law, if you're going to be a doctor, if you're going to be a teacher, you know, as the joke goes, even Joe the plumber has to be licensed in that specific particular state. Now, and whether or not, in some cases, people argue it's a way for backdoor attacks, others say it's a way to be able to ensure a certain level of professional capability per state. The federal government cannot get in the licensure area. They could potentially set guidelines out there for what they think a person should be and potentially withhold funding for the X, but it's still going to be up to the states. And this is set back in the Supreme Court, actually, back in the late 1800s, where the standard was set. So given that, all the states, and why the ABA sent it out to all the states was for that reason, saying, we think this is a bad idea. We think that a new a professional group should be formed. And since that point, we've had no additional states actually fall under, you know, requirement. Some additional things have happened since that point. The state of Virginia, for example, has actually passed legislation that specifically states the opposite, stating that for PI legislation, you do specifically for digital forensic specialists, you do not need to be a PI in the state. And that just passed actually about 6 months ago and signed into law. So in the interesting thing is the basis of some of that was literally lifted from the last minute at night Wednesday session Toby, Jody, and I fought through to get a one-page assessment done. And I see that language, you know, appearing in different areas, which is, you know, it's actually funny because if people knew, like, wow, we're literally, I'm sitting in a hotel room saying, well, what about this word versus that word, you know, last minute. Some of the best things are probably done last minute. In fact, I actually pretty much believe the Constitution was probably an overnight job, you know, if you really think about it. I say everything, they wordsmithed for a while after that point, but it probably, you know, with one or two good, you know, drinks of libation, you know, cider, of course, or something, that they were able to, you know, get this thing, you know, let's get it out there. And the same thing essentially occurred. So we were basically at formation at that point, or Toby and I went back and working with the Lemon PI group, who's working on North Carolina stuff. We forwarded proposals basically saying, well, now what? You know, what if we need to put something together, because even North Carolina said we may revisit this later on if we don't see any professionalization out of the digital forensics community. So that's essentially the background of how we got to the point, you know, fast forward almost 2.5 years later, where we're now at, is which they essentially launched, because these organizations have to be thought out. They have to have bylaws. We've been working for over 2.5 years in the background, where people got hints that something was headed toward this direction, essentially trying to create an umbrella organization. Because one of the biggest issues out there in the digital forensics community is that you have different organizations that represent different needs. You know, for example, you might have organizations that say, we don't want any of our members to be civilians. We want all of them to be law enforcement, which I think is a fair argument. There are discussions that are going on in these groups that they don't want, they want openness, and they want people to feel like their questions aren't going to be found, you know, in a court of law 2 years from now saying, well, look at this, you know, clown. He didn't even know what, you know, a Mac iPhone interface, you know, the pack, you know, flux capacitor plugged into the left ventricle port actually means, you know, something so crazy like that, you know, would be brought out. So, you know, certain groups have their certain needs. So these groups plugged into a larger umbrella organization would end up having their votes inside where's the profession going to go overall. Certain groups out there have their own certifications as well, whether that they're vendor-based certifications or vendor-neutral certifications. So that's another thing, a proponent that we agreed to. It says, well, we can't, you know, we're not going to create another certification, but we do want to take a look at the certifications out there and be able to see if they meet a certain minimal standard. But we do, to a certain extent, want certifications to compete with each other, because that actually promotes excellence. You know, you actually have, you know, standard competition. You might have, you know, greater set of standards that are created out of it. Where we set a minimal standard, well, certification compete against that minimal standard and says, well, we go past the minimum. We're going to do X, or we're going to do Y, or may have a focused certification. So we didn't want to endorse a specific certification. We just want to look at it like you're accrediting an education program, saying, yeah, this is going to teach you what we consider the standard. And then we also need to pull into that ethical, the ethics side to this, which basically, you know, states that with what we're doing in digital forensics, you're touching things that most people could potentially use in blackmail and unethical practices. I mean, there's a ton of things that could potentially happen here because you're touching people's sensitive data, not just on the criminal side, but even civil. But again, it's like we need to set a standard here. It says this is what we consider, you know, ethical practices for everyone in the community. And that's where we're standing right now, is that we actually launched the organization. We are 2.5 years down the line since we initially made some wins with the ABA in North Carolina. But we have a long way to go. And we're basically trying to get individuals to take a look at us and say, yeah, yes, I agree that we need to, as a profession, kind of, you know, figure things out together so we don't have other groups out there dictating to us what we should be doing as a nascent profession, which is essentially what we are at this point.
Okay. So the word that I've heard somebody use is the word lobbyist. Now, how close to being a lobbyist are you? Or if you don't consider yourselves to be lobbyists, then what, you know, what do you consider yourselves to be instead?
It's actually a very good question. For the CDFS, and lobbyists does have its own legal connotations, but I think the overall question, you know, if I could rephrase it a little bit, meaning is acting in support or of advocating for the profession. Is that what you're essentially asking?
Yes.
Is that definitely? Okay. In that sense, yes, we're definitely in an advocation position for the profession. Whether we're going to go into actual do lobbying activities, I have no idea, because that actually is something completely, you know, there's a structure for lobbying, lobbyists, you know, to be able for specific laws. But for now, we are looking toward figuring out what is the best to advocate for the overall profession. Now, here's the thing that's interesting with that is, you know, the, obviously, if you're in a legal mindset, which a lot of us, you know, and it, you know, unfortunately, in some people's minds, get exposed to through this profession, is that then you have to look at, well, what do you define the profession as? And this is where it gets very interesting, because yeah. We even had these discussions, you know, do we consider video specialists a part of this? Do we consider, you know, law enforcement, you know, the legal side? What does e-discovery fit into this? And a lot of these are still, you know, because we have a core center, but then as we move out from the core center, it gets really gray fast. So the question is what does Rob consider the core out of the profession? What are we going to be advocating for are essentially three key areas. And, you know, for anyone who's heard me talk about the profession in general, you'll hear this again, is that you have the legal profession side. Any time a case goes to court that involves digital forensics and you have any type of material that's going to be presented, you know, Casey Anthony, you know, all that from both the criminal and civil side, then those individuals need to be representative expert witnesses. On the law enforcement side, not every single law enforcement case actually makes it to court, but you also have law enforcement collecting data off of larger cases like mafia cases, drug bust, fraud, that they're building a case against one or multiple individuals, that it provides almost an intelligence background of who do we go investigate next? Who is this person talking to? Link analysis is all involved there. So just a reminder, so from the legal side, not every single case that law enforcement is involved in actually makes it to court. But law enforcement obviously has the most clearly defined digital forensics needs that's out there. So law enforcement obviously is going to be included in that. But a close relation to that is here in the States, we call it media exploitation. or document exploitation, where the intelligence communities from the DoD and other intelligence communities are parsing computer systems, not for criminal activity, but it's more on the, you know, nation state, you know, terrorists trying to profile individuals, you know, laptops seized in caves, et cetera, that they're going through this and be able to say, what are their motives? What are they potentially doing with that? So there's an entire intelligence back into this as well that aren't even tied to information security or law enforcement. They're just trying to gather and tweak out intelligence data. So that's a piece of law enforcement side. The reason I group those two together is I call anyone involved in bad guy suppression. That's the second group. And whether bad guy suppression equals throwing people in jail through getting prosecution, or B, that you get intelligence to be able to stop something, you know, yeah, and that could be any number of things. The third piece, the third group that's involved in this core is what I call the information security piece, which you have the information security analysts that are specifically working with digital forensics to the end of being able to investigate how hackers broke into systems. They're also usually tied to HR investigations. Was there fraud? Was there inappropriateness on the inner tubes, you know, being accomplished? All these things are going to be tied to the information security piece. Now, all these are closely related. You could have a hacker intrusion that goes to law enforcement that ends up in court. But again, it's going to be shifting usually from, you know, three different groups at that point as the focus starts to change. Initially, it goes from, you know, investigate to be able to stop the attack, hand that off to law enforcement, and they investigate it to go to the prosecutor. It says, we want to prosecute. Prosecutor then gets the individual thrown in jail. So there's a clear line where the transition would occur. But that's the three groups that are essentially in the bucket of the core related to the CDFS.
So what kind of force or power do you expect CDFS to wield in the coming years? I mean, you've said that you want to try and shape standards and stuff like that, but is that where you're going to stop? Are you looking at, I mean, we mentioned lobbying before, but like in states like Texas where these laws still exist, are you planning, you know, to go at that head on and try and get stuff like that reversed? Or is it, are you just like kind of like laying the foundation for future?
Well, it's really a two-part question. You know, the first part of that is like, you know, what kind of, you know, power are we going to wield, you know, to be able to get the overall task done and be able to represent and, you know, advocate for the profession. Honestly, at the beginning, it's going to be not that much. We're loosely organized at this point. But if you look at the group makeup, you know, we've already have representation from HCCIA, HCCC, yep, IASIS, ISFCE, who has a CCE certification, SANS is on there, obviously, and other groups. And I'm, you know, I'm not, you know, listing them all off, or plus, you know, a consortium of membership as well. We've had groups reach out to us from the DOD. You know, we've had other groups from SWGDE also express some interest in us as well. So right now, you know, until we have the organization really set, you know, like you said, that it's, you know, we're still loosely aligned, but the power is going to come from when we do have that formation of a really concerted effort where everyone's starting to work toward, here's our ethical practices. And mainly, we're going to have to look internally first. We're going to have to set up, you know, what do we define good, decent ethics are. And again, have all the groups be able to vote on that and input it. But again, these are going to be minimal standards. Other groups may have more rigid ethical standards underneath, you know, the overall ones that we're going to set forward here. You know, there's no reason why they couldn't. They said, we want people that are, you know, only in the UK, that are only former law enforcement, that have signed that they will never do X, you know, those type of things. So, okay, that goes beyond, you know, what the original charter would be. But the minimal standards would be what everyone agrees to. The standards, you know, set in place for what do we consider professional standards as well. And we're going to have committees, you know, it's going to take several years to get all of this set and what, you know, and get buy-in from the different groups. But once that's done, it's going to be easier for us to, in these instances, when something like Texas might happen, that we would be able to go and say, well, here's what the profession thinks. And we'd be able to bring that back to the overall group and have a speak with a single voice is to have multiple voices where it looks more chaotic and like a clown show. Whereas here it looks like, well, they have their act together. They're speaking with one voice, the concerns of the group, and they were going to be able to work with legislators and, you know, be able to put forward opinions. And, you know, even with the ABA, it'd be look much stronger if the Consortium of Digital Forensic Specialists and the ABA released a joint opinion versus just the ABA releasing one. And that's where, you know, the ABA releasing an opinion is actually a very powerful statement. So, you know, that's where the power is going to be given from, is that people look to the organization and says, okay, this is an organization that truly represents the needs of the larger conglomerate. And that's, you know, why the word consortium, you know, is we're trying to build that initially. So, you know, just on the initial launch, we've actually seen a lot of groups, you know, perk up a little bit saying, well, they're not going to ask us to do anything that is going to, you know, violate either revenue generation or their own standards that they're going to be creating or have created. But it looks like, well, we will have a say in the larger. And so they will not be able to have this conflict that they've currently been facing internally. It says, well, we don't represent the entire profession. We do represent our smaller portion of it, though.
Right. So you're not after, you're not after becoming some large organization like the Bar Association, for example, where unless you're caught under the CDFS umbrella, that essentially you're not part of digital forensics.
That's well, honestly, we can't head that direction right now. But you know, over years, you know, who knows what will happen? Legislators may say, well, you know, you have to be a member of this organization and, you know, sign up their ethical standards, and then we will look at your licensure in the states if they go to licensure. You know, but even as we said, we don't know what's going to happen at this point. The profession for digital forensic specialists is actually, the analogy actually kind of addressed this is it's almost like as a profession, we're a preemie that was born about 7 months into the pregnancy. Information security, for example, for pen testing and, you know, those individuals, they're actually allowed to go to full term because there's no, you know, standards that are set for them either. A lot of people are talking about standards, but they don't have a, you know, a on the radar threat that, you know, states are starting to pass laws restricting individuals that are trying to work in the infosec field, for example, that says you can't do that unless you're now licensed or licensed X. And if they were, they would probably be happy to do the same thing we are right now. It's like, okay, we need to figure something out here to speak as one voice in order to, you know, get our own opinion out there, whether we think this is a good or a bad idea. So the information security community is actually watching us with interesting, saying, well, that's interesting. What are they doing over there? Because they know that it's coming based off of the amount of discussions that are currently out there that says sooner or later, someone's going to say, in order to do this job I'm currently doing, you will need the following checkboxes to do, whether they're certifications or whether they are certain skills, whether they're a certain ground level of education. I have no idea. You know, but people know that it can't go on for 30 years, 40 years without some sort of standard, you know, because most professions out there have some sort of overall agreement that says to become an architect or an engineer, or in some states, a barber, that you have to go through some sort of minimal level of training. Even dental specialists, nurses, you look at the profession that's out there, eventually there's some formation of what they say, here's the minimal quals for that. And that's what eventually will probably happen to digital forensic specialists. In order to get there, though, we first need to aggregate all of the different groups that have a voice in this and have a buy-in to figure this out, because a lot of groups out there are, you know, potentially saying we're creating standards. Even if you have existing standards, bring them to the table. Let's bring them in and see if these are the standards that are, if they're already there, it saves us work. Maybe we'll just adopt those standards and push them out to be a larger community that says this is what the minimals are. And that's where I think it's really great. We don't have to, we're not recreating the wheel here. We actually look to adopt, if there's existing standards that are out there, send them in, and we'll work with our groups, and then we'll send them out to the overall community to see if this is what individuals want for the minimal standards. And then it's more one community voice, and you don't have pockets of standards being formed. You have a overall group of standards being formed for the entire profession.
So you're looking at kind of like a tree thing, aren't you, where you would have CDFS would pretty much say, right, these are the general standards. And then branching out from that, you're going to have stuff like IASIS, the ISFCE, all that kind of stuff. And obviously they become more specialized as they branch out, but the core standards are all going to be pretty much defined by CDFS.
Well, they're going to be defined by the groups that are involved within CDFS. You know, CDFS is not going to legislate. It's more going to work together with people's on these committees, and that's where the voting comes into play, is that every organization or member with a vote will be able to have their say into whether or not they believe that that is a good, you know, direction for them to go. And so whereas you might have a branch, like you're using your tree analogy, that branch may say, okay, we have the minimal standards that someone must be, you know, 6 foot tall and with a shaved head to do forensics. But we're going to go further than that and say not only there must be 6 foot two, you know, with a shaved head to do forensics, that they must also have a really evil laugh. And with those individuals are going to be a part of our organization. That's great. But again, as most organizations say, well, what do you define your minimums as? I mean, a good example I know is going to come up for discussion are, you know, defense side. You know, a lot of organizations say we don't want anyone who does defense work in here to be able to. And that's, I completely get why they do that. But the overall profession has to focus on both sides of that coin. But an organizational chapter that's signed on to CDFS, they could have their own. You know, as long as they voted upon the standards that are there, they're going to have their own implementation that goes beyond it potentially if they want to.
I'm trying to get in my mind now. Okay, so let's say, for example, you had somebody who perhaps has the CCE or the CFCE or something like that, and let's say they came under the umbrella of CDFS. So they all have the standard there laid out for them by CDFS and by the individual certifying body. But then you have somebody who isn't a part of any of those, who perhaps, you know, just does the computer forensic stuff out of their own home or something like that, and they had no interest in getting a certification. How is CDFS going to benefit those specific people? Why should they come in to join? Because, I mean, after all, they're one person. What benefit are they going to have from that?
Well, it's actually a really good question, because you have the organizations, you also have individual membership that you'll be able to sign on with. You know, again, for the profession, as it stands right now, it's not obviously a requirement to join CDFS, so no. You don't have to do that. But if you're earning a living doing this, and this is what you're passionate about, and you would like to be able to have your voice as a part of those discussions, that's why someone would join initially right now. You know, this is not an organization where you really join and say, hey, you're going to get discounts. We could eventually get to that point. Or say, hey, you know, if you sign up, you'll be able to, you know, test for the certification and, you know, we're the number one. It's not really about that. You know, what we're really trying to set forward is we want to be speaking with one voice. And if, as I said to certain individuals that have asked me about it, I said, if digital forensics is something that you care about and you're interested in, you know, seeing where it's going to go, being a part of a committee, being a part of being able to review these documents and be able to have your say in it, that may be worth the individual membership, where you do get a vote, you know, on the board members, your representation. You know, you'll be able to see the documents and be able to say, yeah, I like this, but not this. You know, here's a concern of mine, you know, and it's that working together atmosphere. It's like you're not going to be alone and have legislation pass that you're not going to be able to, you know, stay from a certain state saying, hey, listen, I'm happen to be in Hawaii. Wow, Hawaii all of a sudden is doing X. Did you know about this? CDFS helped me because I may be put out of business. Well, you have an organization that would probably pay attention to you now. Whereas if you were not a part of another organization, you know, you may not have that potential, basically calling, you know, support, you know, to be able to help you out. This potentially might give you that, you know, because as we said, we're going to be advocating for it. We are greatly concerned about legislation being passed down from the states that are knee-jerk reactions to this instead of well-thought-out professional standards, you know, in order to make sure that people have the right qualifications to do this job. And, you know, again, in any of the subgroups, it doesn't matter if you're in information security or if you're working in third party doing, you know, media exploitation for law enforcement of some sort. You know, all these things are going to be combined, and we're all going to have a, you know, buy-in interest to be able to make sure that we're going to still be able to do our jobs, not just tomorrow, but, you know, 5 years from now. You know, if you're looking at starting your own practice, you know, in, which is what I'm doing right now, I'm worried that, you know, well, I need to be licensed in 50 states in order to do this.
Yeah.
You know, there may be costs to an entrepreneur that are unseen at this point and could destroy your business, you know, 3 or 4 years from now. And if you care about that, that's where as an individual you potentially want to, you know, join and look toward the CDFS to, you know, be able to review that and have your input.
So, like, you got the pocket organizations like the New York Security, NY4SEC. So that that organization, obviously, they meet quite frequently and is they discuss things which matter to them in that little pocket of the US. So would you consider CDFS to be like the big brother for organizations like that, where the things that they discuss, things which matter to them and are affecting their work, you would hope they would relay that information onto you and you can help and support them and let other people know about the same kind of things?
Yeah, you know, I would hate to see Big Brother because, you know, Big Brother kind of has, like, you know, the...
We
could overpower you or something like that. But, I mean, it's more that, you know, like, each organization, at least in, this is my opinion, of course, that I don't see CDFS, you know, being a bully or being able to say, hey, guys, you know, we're going to revoke your membership or unless you fall on Earth. But, you know, the real idea between this is that we're trying to come together as a single voice, as a much larger voice. So if there's something that... they come up with, or any group comes up with and says, you know, we're concerned about this and we would like to see, you know, what the consortium as well as the other groups think about this. Now you potentially have a forum to be able to bring it up and saying, you know, this has just happened. This could happen. You know, how would we potentially, you know, form a strategy to be able to bring this up for discussion to see if this is going to be a trend or is this something that, you know, just happened to be a one-off? And that's where, you know, again, the organizations that are a part of this would be able to come to that and be able to have a speaking voice at the table. I almost think of it, you know, going into the King Arthur, you know, Knights of the Round Table, that's really what we're trying to do here, is that everyone has a place at the table, has a voice, and there's not one group out there that's going to be larger than the other ones. It's, you know, we all have our own interests. We all have our own plot of land that we're potentially looking at attending. But the reason that we're together is that we have to look toward the, you know, solidification of the profession as a whole in order to be able to also protect our own lands. And that's where even if you have a smaller group out there, even a very small group of 10 people from a local region that says, hey, listen, we want to join because we, you know, we do have our own concerns out here, or even from another country, you know, and this is not, you know, if you notice our symbol, it's not a U.S.-based thing. We're really looking at trying to figure this out, not just for the U.S., but across the planet. There are any organization that potentially is interested in potentially coming up with the overall standards. And again, you know, we're looking at minimals initially to be able to say, what is the profession? And if you want to sit at the round table with the rest of us, here's how you potentially do that. And you get your say into the formation of what do we consider, you know, how are we all come together to be able to speak as one voice?
Very cool. Yeah, the thing which it makes me think of is that I don't know if you're familiar with F3 over here in the UK, the First Forensic Forum. It sounds as if you guys have got very, very similar kinds of goals. They go about it slightly differently, though. But yeah, go on, sorry.
A lot of organizations actually, you know, and that's where it says, well, you sound like you have a lot of goals. Most organizations have ended up having almost a similar set of foundations. We're going to have ethics. We're going to look toward, you know, creating standards. We're going to look toward, you know, some groups form certifications. But the interesting thing is that, you know, because of where these groups have usually formed is that they may leave out some of the other groups. Like, you know, what about the information security folks or what about the intelligence community? You know, you may end up leave out a pocket of that. And that's where, you know, we're trying to, you know, kind of sit one level above that to where you see, all that work you've already done, don't let it go to waste. In fact, bring it to this overall group here and let everyone take a look at it. And then potentially your group would still be seen as leading it, saying, hey, listen, we have a really good idea that we would like to propose this to the other groups to be able to see what do you guys think about. Also, this is one of our minimal standards. This is what we figured out, done years of research on. how are we going to be able to do that? So a lot of other organizations, there's a couple of even up at DC3 that have also looking toward, you know, creating an overall standards. Some of this work has already been done, and we realize that. We actually want to get those groups involved so that they don't feel like they have to do duplicative effort, that if they really want their objectives and their work product to see the most eyeballs within the digital forensics profession, here's their springboard is what we're aiming for. Here's how they're going to be able to have the greatest effect instead of the greatest effect in their pocket or region. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We just want to have everyone help us polish it is what it comes down to.
How do people go about joining this and what options do they have for that?
CDFS can be joined by going out to the website, cdfs.org. If you're part of an organization, I would bring it up with the organizational's board and have them reach out to anyone on our board in a good membership. Under the About Us tag, you're going to be able to find, you know, every single individual that's out there, including myself. You may already have someone on the board from your organization. Reach out to them if you want to say, hey, listen, what is our organization's thoughts on CDFS? What are we currently doing with it? That's what I would say would be the first step. If, you know, if you're not a part of any organization, you want to directly sign up for membership right now, you can. There is an individual membership, which you do get a vote, but we do have organizational memberships as well. So first ask your organizational memberships, hey, you know, CDFS has started, you know, instead of thinking that, well, that's another group that's doing the same thing we are, take a look at us and reach out to us and say, hey, how can we work together? How would we be able to take what we're doing and, you know, bring it into the larger conglomerate with what, you know, we're not to be the bullies out there, but we're really trying to be an advocate, not just for one group, but, you know, try to get all the groups to a single table, that Knights of the round table concept. So that's the two ways. Either you can sign up as an individual or B, check out your organization, talk to your organization's board, bring it up to them. If there's no movement on it, do an introduction with one of us to your board and saying, hey, can you guys talk to this group over here and see if there's, you know, any interest in figuring out how to work together. That's the steps I would go through, because right now is where people are getting these discussions are happening internally to a lot of groups. What is the impact of this group? You know, what do they have under their belts at this point? Honestly, right now, not much, because we just launched. But, you know, 6 months of, you know, building up the organizations, we're going to start moving forward. And the time to sign on is now for organizations or members to be a part of it from the beginning. So you're not, you know, looking at standards and some of the things that would have to be brought up again later, revisited, because we have, you know, different concerns to potentially meet the needs for the overall organizations that would be potentially part of this.
Okay, fantastic. And for individual type membership, because I know you offer both organization and individuals, what do the individuals need to do if they want to join?
There's a PDF that they would just simply need to fill out, email back. It's on the actual PDF itself where to email it to. And then there's a payment of $75 US dollars that is going to be required. And again, we're a nonprofit organization. We're not doing this for revenue generation, but we do need, you know, obviously a lot of things are going to be going on, and we do need the revenue to be able to survive. We're not, in all honesty, we're trying to make this as economical as possible, but also meet the bare minimums of the needs in order to be able to move the ball forward. Right now, we're still nascent, so things might change over the next couple of years, but we certainly hope that out of the benefits of being able to join early is that you're going to immediately be able to feel like you're part of something and that you're going to be looking at something that they're going to ask your input on. So we know $75 is a lot for a lot of individuals out there, and I totally recognize that. If that's a lot, then I would really push your organizational that you're already part of to potentially join, because you're already probably paying dues there. So try to convince your board membership saying, hey, listen, get the organization to join. And so we could speak through the board our concerns. So, you know, both of those potentials are ways to join. So the organization and the individual membership PDFs are actually on our website under membership.
I don't know if I've missed anything, if there's anything else you want to bring up about the organization at all.
Well, one of the new committees within CDFS is actually going to be the digital forensicators that have appeared on Star Trek episodes.
Oh, no.
apparently, you've already been nominated to lead that committee. I don't know if you knew this or not, but no, all joking aside, actually not. If anyone has no idea what I'm talking about, all you have to do is go into Google and type Star Trek and Lee Whitfield. And Lee's the skinny one.
It's not very often you hear that.
And he's 17 years old when he did it, but it's definitely a, like, wow, that is Lee. same grin. So unfortunately, as I said earlier, before we started the podcast, that every time I introduce you now, I'm going to be mentioning that as a part of your resume that you fought Klingons off the bridge of the Enterprise. So congrats on that.
Oh boy. Right.
You don't even know what to say to that.
No, of course not.
I've gone to great lengths to make sure I have no real bad videos online.
I've already downloaded them all. We'll be publishing them soon. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Rob. It's been a pleasure as always.
Lee, it is always a pleasure speaking with you.
And obviously, I think that this is obviously something which people need to really take very, very seriously and have a good look at. We've known about this coming for quite a while now. It was posted on the Sense Forensic blog some time ago, something about CDFS. I believe I mentioned it at the time, but just this is really what we're going to have to do, in my opinion, to move forward in the field, because there's things which happen which are out of our control, which may be forced upon us. I mean, one thing which comes to mind, I don't know necessarily if you have an opinion on this or not, Rob, but over here we have the forensic regulator, who's employed by the government to essentially oversee all forensic activity in the UK. And one of the things that he's said is that digital forensics now needs to move into getting, in, you know, not properly certified, but getting ISO 17025 for laboratory testing and all that kind of stuff, which some of it is, you know, does apply. A lot of it probably doesn't apply, and possibly this is one of those areas where CDFS may be getting involved in the future. I don't know, but
well, it's interesting you bring that up, because, you know, as I think Eric's mentioned, and you know the question comes up, you know, like, here we have the ASCLAD certification, and do all laboratories need this level of scrutiny? You know, and this is where it does come up to be a larger discussion. And honestly, no, not every laboratory does need that level of scrutiny. In fact, you potentially start restricting yourself on certain types of technologies that may actually allow people to do still decent digital forensics work. But again, it's going to be from, you know, remote locations or others. And plus, not all fields, you know, from media exploitation or even InfoSec, require that level of scrutiny for the types of work that they're going to do. So, you know, again, looking at the larger picture here, we may say, well, we endorse this for law enforcement laboratories only or something like that. But trying to say that we're going to set a restriction and not try to take into account, does that make sense across all the potential outgrowths of digital forensics at this point? Is going to be a specific focus of mine. It's because I grew up in the information security and law enforcement fields, and it is night and day. You know, and I, you know, touched in the media exploitation side as well. And all sides of that piece of dice, you know, have completely different needs. So saying, you know, hey, we need to enforce a standard for digital forensics laboratories, my next question is, well, for which pieces? You know, are we going to look at this on a macro or micro level? And that some of these questions may actually, you know, be centered on that, but initially it's going to be a larger picture as, you know, do we endorse really strict or really, you know, what is the minimal laboratory configurations for doing any DF work across the board? And a lot of people will be surprised. It says, well, if you're in InfoSec, it may be you have a computer that's tied to an enterprise network. You know, you're able to do this, you know, using specific types of software. I mean, who knows? But it comes down to, it's a discussion that needs to happen, and it cannot be stovepiped into a single need of single org. Commercial companies come to me and saying, should we get ASCLAD certified? And I tell them, no, you do not need to do it because you're not, you know, there's, you're going to be restricting your stuff, and that level level of need's not going to be done for your stuff. But again, that's only my opinion, but that's why we need to pop it up to a larger picture here.
Yep. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Lee, again. And like I said before, you know, and as you highlight, this is, it's important stuff. Everyone, you know, if you could just be, we're like any organization, we're going to be moving a little slow, not intentionally. I mean, some of these things, you know, don't expect in 6 months, all of a sudden, you know, every single standard's going to be figured out. It's, you know, this is going to be a metamorphosis that it's going to take some time to get through. And we don't have all the answers right now. You know, we have a lot of balls that we've just tossed in the air. And we kind of need to see where some of them land at this point and see how things move forward. But I completely believe in the mission of where we're headed with this. And it's to be as inclusive as possible and to bring all organizations that have a buy-in to digital forensics to the table so that they do truly have a voice.
Excellent. I have a feeling that the board members for CDFS are going to be very, very busy for some time to come, which is perfect for you because you have lots of free time on your hands now, especially with twins on the way and all that fun stuff.
I'm training for a triathlon. My wife's pregnant with twins. I'm starting a business. I'm doing a major update to 508 for SANS and authorship there and also teaching. And then I also am doing CDFS on the side. So, bam, I don't ever have a boring day.
What do you do in your free time then?
Xbox, watch comic book movies. Joe Garcia and I definitely have a love of those. But and read comic books, actually. I'm a big comic book nerd.
Awesome. Mark is as well, I've heard.
Yes, he sent me a lot of his comic books. I fully appreciate it. He's trying to bribe me so I would never refer to him as my favorite tool anymore. So,
he teaches a class at a university, and they've become aware of his nickname now as well. So, oh well. It's not my fault. I just work here. All right. Well, that was fantastic. Thank you very much. If people want to know more, obviously go to cdfs.org or contact, you know, any of the board members who you might be familiar with. I mean, this is like a fantasy football team of digital forensic investigators, really. You know, you got Ovi on there. You got Owen Casey. Eric is on there. Gary Kessler, Troy Larson, obviously Rob and Cindy. So it's just, if you want to know more about any of that, get in touch with them, visit the website, do something like that. But this is, I really feel strongly about this, and I have a feeling my membership will be coming up very, very soon. So yeah, that's all we got for you this time on Forensic Forecast, and please come back and listen to us again. Bye for now. This podcast is brought to you in part by Disc Labs, offering a range of services such as forensic data recovery, digital forensics, and certified data erasure. Find out more at disclabs.com.